Have you ever wondered how to balance a high-powered career with family life, all while making a significant impact on climate change? Let's dive into it.
I'm very good. If I know I have 45 minutes and then I'll pick up my kids, then I get a lot done in 45 minutes.
Meet Dörte Hirschberg, a trailblazer in the world of climate tech investing and a master of work-life balance. In this episode, we will explore Climentum Capital's unique approach to climate tech investing, the challenges and opportunities in the green sector, how to balance family and career, the role of white papers in the climate tech space, and the future of our planet. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button to stay updated on our latest episodes. Let's embark on this insightful journey together. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the conversation. Let's dive in.
And we now go to the live custom streaming, and then everything is good. And we can proceed with the questions. Dörte, it's very good to see you today on the podcast. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for being here. Yeah, so I have been an angel investment since my time at Rocket, and I started with consumer and software topics, and over time this got more and more purposeful and sustainable. And I just felt with the money I have, given all the great chances I had in life, I should do something good and something that makes sense for us and for the planet. And then in 2019, 2020, I realized that now is a moment where there are so many great technologies and great companies which can be commercially extremely attractive and financial cases for investors, but also have a big impact on the planet. Because it's so urgent now, everybody needs to act. And that gives a unique opportunity. And then I was convinced, okay, I need to do this. Yeah, I need to find the right people to do it together. And then I need to start this.
That's very good to hear. Can we stay a little bit at the basic definitions of climate change and climate investing and climate tech? I grew up on the countryside, and I give you just a background why I ask this question. I grew up on the countryside. My grandparents had a small, very tiny little farm in Upper Styria. And anytime when I tried to throw away anything plastic or aluminium, a can, for example, my grandmother was very upset. And she told me from early age, take care of the environment, don't pollute it, keep it clean. And if you don't keep it clean, I hunt you down. So it was basically farmer's life. When I view the world now through this lens, for me, it's quite clear that we have to do everything that's necessary to keep the environment safe and working and intact. I mean, it's the only home that we have. And if we destroy it, it's the end of society. Why is there currently so much fuss around this topic? To me, it seems very logical to do something. But whenever I open the media, there is a lot of coverage. Why did this change in the last year? I mean, 5 years ago, there was almost nothing. And now we have this big, which is a very good thing. We have now this big press coverage. What's your definition of climate change, and why do you think with your fund it's very urgent?
Yeah. So the facts around climate change are known for decades, but it was never so pressing. And it was also not so visible to all of us. So we experience hotter summers, drier summers. We see more floods in other areas. So this is something that is now there, and no one can ignore it. The other thing is that the current energy prices and also the rareness of some materials that we need and the increased prices in raw materials have also made many business cases more viable. So it makes it makes a lot of sense to install solar. It makes a lot of sense to save energy and invest in technologies that just reduce energy usage, to recycle or to use other materials that are not rare or earth materials. So many things make sense from a business case point mm-hmm. of view. They haven't 5 or 10 years ago. So this is why now also the big money is coming in. Yeah, I also come from McKinsey, not from philanthropy. Yeah, it makes sense, but it's also it's an investment case. And on the contrarian, fossil cases and all, it's very clear that they will have an end and that money needs to shift big times. And I think this combination makes it now so interesting.
Yeah, I think also the Middle East is moving towards green investments, interestingly. For me, I mean, Elon Musk is a very controversial person, but recently I saw a presentation from him where he presented his battery solution. And that solar will save the planet and will drive down the cost. And it makes a whole lot of sense. So I have it on my YouTube channel. When I think back at my work with venture capitalists, I have a pharma background, mostly in pharma. So they invest in patents. Anytime when I presented the case that was very hardware heavy with a scientific company, they shied away and said, no, we don't invest in hardware. Then I experienced the shift towards the digital age. And we had a lot of investors here in Austria and also in Europe who invested in software. And every time when I approached them and said, hey, here's a nice hardware tool, it's very helpful, they said, no, we don't invest in that. I perceive this climate tech as very hardware intense. What, in your opinion, is this pull towards hardware intense investments right now? It's a completely game shift in reality, in my opinion.
Absolutely. So there is also software in climate tech. Yeah, there are software tools that can improve energy efficiency, make houses smarter. There are also tools that can monitor ESG and climate related stuff or track it. So there is a lot of software. And this is the space that more traditional VC funds feel very comfortable in. And that is why we as climate focused companies often find these companies overhyped, and also the competition is very high. So for ESG tracking, there are many companies out there. But then at the end, I mean, CO2 is a gas. So you need physical products. You need engineering, biotech, chemistry to solve the larger part of the problem. And yes, hardware is harder. Yeah. And this is why many funds say we don't do it right away. And there are also reasons for it. Yeah. So it does generally take time. More time. There are very few hardware processes that can scale software like if you remember WhatsApp, yeah. So they programmed something in a few weeks and it had millions of users quickly. Yeah. So that's very unlikely to happen in hardware. But we are convinced that there are enough hardware cases that are still fast growing enough to be a venture capital case. And venture capital for us, we are a fund with a 10+3 lifetime. So which means if we invest now, we should see an exit potential in 6-7 years. And so we have some rules. One is we can't invest in pure science. So we typically need a product that already works, at least in pilot stage. There should be some customers, maybe the B2B sales process is still long and ongoing, but first customers should be there. We also need teams that are not the 25, 28 out of university who have a big dream and just work a lot. We need teams who can scale industrially, yeah, who can make negotiations with large corporates and all that stuff. So there are things that we need to see. Also the CapEx question. So we need to have an answer. How do we finance the next rounds? And if this involves CapEx, what is a smart way to do it? Because there is still a gap in financing a first-of-a-kind plant, which you often need. And more players are involving to do that. But it's not that easy. So these are the things that we have become experts in and we know. And this is why we believe this is a risk that we can manage and handle and that has great upside for us.
Let's say a little bit about, you made very important points. So let's dissect it step by step and start with the first one. Before we come to the team and why you're investing in more experienced teams and not young teams, let's stay first with why invest in hardware in the climate tech space from the LP side. Did I understand you right that from your perception, software in climate change in ESG investing is a little bit overhyped, but nobody wants to go into hardware right now. So there is a huge opportunity sitting on the table. Is that the right perception?
Yeah, not nobody, but definitely. Yes.
I mean, Tesla is, I think, in my opinion, a good example. I mean, Tesla is mostly hardware. They put cars on the street, solar panels on rooftops, batteries. Do we see similar companies in Europe on the hardware side? Like so the next Tesla, for example, could evolve out of Europe?
So we invested, for example, in a company called Quantum from Sweden, and they do heat pumps. Mm. And they have heat pump technologies for urban applications. So for large buildings where you have a big one in the down and then modular things. And this is a company that is growing massively and now planning the second manufacturing plant. And yes, that can show such attraction. We also have the battery manufacturers, Northvolt in Sweden also. H2 Green Steel, a very ambitious project to make green steel. So these are some companies that definitely have the potential.
So there's a lot going on in Europe still, and not only in the United States. It's very good to hear that we at least in this area still are on the competitive landscape. Let's look at the team and your investment style a little bit, because I think it's very important for LPs that might be interested to work with you in future. You mentioned, and in my opinion, it's also the basic reasons, or it's the basic setup when a company should address VCs, and if they don't have it, they shouldn't. You mentioned that you want experienced team on one hand, and on the other hand, you are looking for a clear go-to-market strategy, if I interpreted a little bit. So you want to have at least a working prototype, something that proves that the concept works, and a team who understands how to bring it to the market, how to negotiate with larger corporation, and ideally then sell a team. Do I get the right impression from Climentum's investment style?
Yeah, very good. Very good summary. Yes, the team. So typical hardware teams, for example, in Germany, are often from universities. They have developed some really great patent and a technology that could really solve big problems. But many of these companies end relatively small and never get this big traction and become a Tesla or whatever. Mm. Yeah. And then on the other hand, we have in Germany a lot, in Berlin, this scene of entrepreneurs who are business people with no big technical expertise, but all the know-how, how to scale quickly, and also this MVP thinking, minimum viable product, how can we get something in the next months and then just get it out and try it and make it better. And it's not that easy to merge these two cultures and to find teams who have both of that and who work well together. It starts with the locations. One are in Berlin and some are in Karlsruhe. Yeah, maybe in Munich you have more synergies like that. But it's also the mindset and the culture. So this is something that we need to see. And then you typically also need people in the team who can not only scale big, but who can also talk to corporations and negotiate large contracts and be seen as a valuable counterpart. And this is something that we need to look at. And ideally, the team has it all, or at least they know of the gaps and how to fill them. And this is very, very important. Yeah.
Yeah, I could not agree more. Marrying science with business is a science by itself. I was always the person when a scientist approached me who said, who needs that? What is an application for that? Where is the patient? And sometimes, as I said, I mean, scientists don't like sometimes science and not translating products into, or science into products. The question that I have now for you is the mission of Climentum Capital. I think it always needs a visionary on a team. And my question, and what I find interesting, is like people with like Elon Musk or others like Steve Jobs, for example, who had this big vision and developed big companies. How did your vision evolve? What how did you find it to focus solely on CO2 investing to get rid of this problem? Was the first emission, or did you find the emission while you were working on something else?
Yeah, so we met as a team during 2020. It was virtually because we are from Berlin and Copenhagen and Stockholm, and this was big COVID time, so we couldn't even meet physically the first month. And we came from different angles and had different perspectives. And I'm definitely not the impact and impact measurement expert in the team. We have others. But what they convinced me about, and what makes a lot of sense, is that climate change and CO2 emissions is the one impact topic that you can measure with figures that are very solid and where you have a scientific base on the assumptions and the European taxonomy and stuff that you can base this on. And this allows us to make our impact target for the fund as credible as our financial target. So we have a financial target and a hurdle rate for our carry, and we have the same on the impact side. And this is, at the moment, in this year, this is only possible for CO2 or CO2 equivalents. You can have other impact categories, yeah, education, social stuff, biodiversity, very, very, very important topics. But there you need to do it more qualitative, because you cannot compare, I don't know, millions of cancer patients who live longer with kids who receive better education and more insects in a certain area. Yeah? You cannot compare that. This needs to stay qualitative. And we like this, this opportunity to really measure what we do and to also talk to the financial community and finance-driven investors in a language that they speak. And we say, hey, we deliver this IRR and this much climate impact. Yeah,
I couldn't agree more. From coming from the finance side, having one KPI that you can clearly measure makes a huge difference. But on the other hand, when you open the newspaper, I think it also opens up a lot of criticism, who say, why is there CO2? Why not something else? What's your opinion? Why is CO2 the best KPI that we currently have to measure when we want to measure any impact on the environment? I mean, it's a complex system. You have a lot of variables to juggle with. Why is CO2, in your opinion, the best one?
It's not the best, but it's the only one that is standardized so far in the impact community, so that you can really compare a recycling technology with vegan cheese, and you can say this can save so much and this so much. And I would definitely not say that this is the most important KPI or whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Biodiversity, for example, is also something that is definitely very, very important.
But can you measure the impact on biodiversity of a...
qualitative, yeah. So you can, of course, and if you have a certain technology, you can in a certain area measure something, yeah. So, but it's not on a global scale, and you cannot compare it to CO2 or to something else, yeah. So it's not the one figure. But that doesn't mean that it's not important. We need also funds to invest in that, and this can also make financial sense. But it's just our focus. We decided, okay, let's take this battle, and quite frankly, a lot has also positive impact on climate change. And so, for example, we have done investments in the space where we avoid plastic, and their CO2 is only one of several impact factors. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this whole ocean plastic, and which then comes to biodiversity and to other problems, is not directly related to CO2. And of course, we also account that in our impact due diligence. So we calculate the CO2, but then we also say, and in addition, there are other things that we really like and find important. And this is, of course, something that we don't ignore. And we have the freedom to also do investments which are not super great climate cases, but very good, and that have additional great impact dimensions. Yeah.
So when I sum it up for any startup founder or any founder who wants to approach you, they should have at least one slide where they clearly show the CO2 impact of their technology.
Yes. Yes, that's very helpful for us. Yeah.
That's now let me ask you the killer question that I usually get from VCs. Now I can ask you this question. There is always when I started investing in public companies, initially I followed every trend. So I felt, everybody's investing, it must be good. And this is exactly when I learned it's not the right time to invest then, because it's already overhyped. I think Warren Buffett points that out very often. And also other famous investors have quotes, don't invest in highs, invest in lows. The question I have to you now is, and VCs frequently ask me that when I run companies, what makes you different in your industry? So what sets you apart? Why should LPs invest in you? What's your USP? What is something that others cannot do? What do you do better?
Yeah. So one thing is definitely that we are more technical than others. We also have engineers in our team. We also know the investor landscape that is not VC, but that is more infrastructure, debt, private equity related, that can also invest in hardware. So we know more about this stuff. One other thing is that our geographic footprint is a big advantage. Scandinavia is in many green technologies a bit ahead, but it's small. So companies who do something great in Denmark or Sweden, they are very happy that we have the access to Germany, which is just big. And on the other hand, many German startups like our connections to the Nordics, where it's maybe easier to convince some B2B customers and to have some discussions. Yeah, so this is also definitely unique. And when you spoke about these hype and bubble topics, I think this is our job as an investor to have strong thesis and to view these, look at these topics that where valuations increase and where the hype increase, and position yourself smartly to that. So for example, we looked at the hydrogen space, and we are very convinced that hydrogen will be an important part to decarbonize big industry. Mm-hmm. And there are many, and electrolyzer companies have seen super high valuations and high rounds without much revenue or anything like that. So we said, no, this is not for us. We won't go into electrolyzers. And we invested now into a company that does the electrodes for electrolyzers, which is a critical component, around 25% of the cost, and still with not good efficiency and durability. So we did an investment there. Other segments, for example, in transportation, we said this whole electric vehicle and cars, that's over. That's not for early stage anymore. We look at other segments within transportation, so more goods transportation and shipping and stuff like that, which will learn from cars, mm-hmm, and trucks, but which will still be different. Yeah. So I think this is our task.
I couldn't agree more. There's a lot of hype around electric vehicles, but they also see on the public sectors, there are many big companies, advanced, evolved, developed. China, for example, has some nice companies. The United States, Tesla, I think, is still the best one. The question that comes to my mind now after listening to you is, I mean, you mentioned initially philanthropy. So you're a fund, you want to make money at the end of the day. And very often when I address this point of making money, making profits at the end of the day, I get a hard pushback from scientists to say, okay, it's all about money. You're just talking about money. We want to save the planet. And what I find very compelling in your story is that you want to do both. So on one hand, you want to save our planet, and on the other hand, but also you're financially aware. How is this for you to balance these two, to juggle with these two topics? What is your experience in this area?
Yeah. So in the climate tech community, there is also a group which says we need to stop the growth momentum, and we need to end the capitalistic system, which always wants to sell more and more and more. Mm. And I think that's a very fair and interesting point. And I love debating about it. But it's not very realistic, and it's for us as individuals or whatever. It's also hard to realize. And I personally, I'm more convinced that the the capitalistic system will stay at least for the next one or two decades. Yeah. So the stuff that I can now foresee, mm-hmm. But that the governments and other regulators will try to bring it into the right directions and make regulations and carbon markets and all that stuff to ensure that this capitalistic system, which is imperfect, moves into to the right direction. Yeah. And this is what I'm convinced, and not everybody is. And this allows me to work together with large corporations. So for example, we have BASF as an LP investor in our fund. Yeah. Others would say, hey, BASF, they're chemical companies there. They do a lot of bad things. Yes, I know, but there are also thousands of people within BASF who are trying every day to make that better and to reduce their emissions.
Don't worry, I have shares of BASF. So.
and also financial investors and LPs, yes. Many people that we speak to, we know that they also have money in oil and gas and all that. And this will be a process, yeah, that they will not say, oh, now we invest a bit in Climentum and we shut down all this legacy. No, but they are, so then it's rather my task to make their progress towards green quicker and give them opportunities to change what they do into something more green and sustainable than to just not work with them or ban them completely. Yeah. So this is of course a very pragmatic approach that I'm happy to debate. Yeah. But this is our starting point, I would say. Yeah.
I mean, if you want to debate the end of capitalism, we can spend a little bit of time on that, which, I mean, I don't understand this movement. When I look, for example, electric vehicles, the European Union decided that's the way forward. And how I see it is that one of the visionaries who made this decision possible was not in Europe. He was in the United States, in my opinion, Elon Musk. So he pushed this topic very hard forward with his own money, with his own capital. And the capitalist system gave him sufficient funds with the acquisition of PayPal from eBay to push this vision, I think, on a global scale into the internet. And he didn't make much money for I think about a decade. It's now that Tesla is becoming big. Yeah. I think without the capitalist systems, people like, these are my favorites. So if you have other role models, feel free to offer them. But Steve Jobs, for example, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, for example, with Windows, he did a lot of good work during the pandemic with vaccine development with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Without the capitalist system, they wouldn't have sufficient funds to do that and to lead the charge. What is your view on the capitalist system?
So fundamentally, I am with you. Yeah, I also love this entrepreneurial stories and the technologies that move something to the better. That's also my core belief. But it's also fair, for example, in the Tesla case, if you have now a 5-year-old diesel and you replace it with a new Tesla, this will depend a lot on your driving pattern, but it's not necessarily super green because it has also a lot of lithium, which has many problems, and the whole production process, and aluminium, which is a light material, is also super problematic. Mm. So it's good that you have a Tesla, but of course it would be even better if you would move to public transport and reduce your travel overall. And this is also a fair point, yeah. So this is a fine balance, and I think reduction of certain consumption will also be part of the equation, yeah. So, but we are all humans, and I think humans are collaborative, as you mentioned, your grandparents who told you don't throw away stuff. I mean, in Germany, almost everybody is sorting the trash every day. It's a lot of extra effort. We all do it. So, I also know so many people who take the bike also when it's raining and really try to do an effort, not throw away food. And I think we can also do more there. Yeah. But this is a process. And if you would ban, I don't know, vacation flights, this would, you wouldn't get a majority for that. And I'm convinced on capitalism, at least on if it has some boundaries, but I'm also convinced on democracy. And for democracy, you need the majority. And this is what makes me so angry about these guys who glue themselves on the street, because they risk actually that the majority of the normal people are supportive and are willing to go their way and now install the heat pumps, save energy where they can, exchange the light bulbs and all the stuff that we actually do. Yeah.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, when you explain it in calm words, logical to people, I think they simply follow when it's logical, when it's the right thing to do, they do that. Talked a little bit about, I mean, I have a 20-year-old diesel. I looked at the EV space a couple of years ago and said, yeah, let's go green. And then I did a little bit of calculation in the background and said, no, wait a minute. How often do I use my car? And it's basically once a month. I'm in Vienna, I use public transport, and quickly came to the conclusion, if I replace my car now, I mean, my car is there, it's here. When I buy a new car, probably a 20-year-old car would be disposed. So it's gone. It's of no use for anybody anymore. And a new Tesla or any other car, NIO is coming to Europe right now, has a huge negative impact right from the start when I compare it to my old diesel, which I already have. So my decision back then was, don't buy a new car, drive it until it dies, and then you can decide what you do and what you don't do. These arguments then, which coming very often from the left wing, ending capitalism, finding better system, finding new systems. I'm very open to discuss that and listen to the arguments. But anytime when I consider it and think about it, I don't find a better system. The only inequality in the system is that people who know how to play the game just make more money because they know the rules. And people who don't know the rules are basically not very good in playing the game, but this can be easily fixed with education. Are you aware of a better system than capitalism? Do you have anything in your social circle or anybody who has a groundbreaking idea and says, when we do this and that, we get to a better system?
And no, but we should continuously improve it and learn from other countries. And I'm now exposed a lot to Scandinavia, which is maybe a bit more socialistic than Germany. And I think there are on many ways there are things how we can balance the system. Yeah, and I think we need to, the capitalism always will create big winners, and we always need to take a lot from them and give it to the others and try to give similar opportunities to all. And I mean, in Germany, we're falling totally behind on that. And with the immigration that will stay the next decades, also due to climate change and due to fossil wars and all, we will have immigration. But we need to ensure that these kids and families get integrated and can work in the society. And this is so we need to balance it. Absolutely. And I'm much more for higher tax and these rules and carbon credits. And we can do way more to take money from the rich and to balance it better. And that I'm all for, but there the devil lies in the detail. Yeah. So every measure has pros and cons, and I don't want to be a politician. It's super hard. Yeah. And again, we need to take the majority with us, and the majority in our countries are the boomer generation. So the now 50, 60, 70 year old. And that is not easy, to do something against this majority. So we need to take them with us and ensure that this generation, and I think fundamentally this generation, they all have kids and grandkids. They also want to leave the planet healthy. But this is a process.
Yeah, now we have all critical topics on the table. So
yes.
when you want to start
a fund, to our fund and to the.
No, I really love this conversation. So because I mean, in communication training, you always hear if you want to start a fight, talk about politics, talk about religion, or talk about anything that's critical right now. And so we have everything on the table and we are not fighting, definitely. Let's tackle the next, very diverse topic on the internet, diversity in your team. Your team members are not the traditional finance guys, white old men in suits. You have a diverse, active and young team. Can you describe your team a little bit?
Yes. So we have two women on the team, Marlin and me, and that itself in the founding team to have two women is very rare. And it's a big benefit and it makes it all better. On top of that, Marlin.
Sorry to interrupt you. You think two women are rare in a leadership role?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
So of course it depends in the industry, and if you there are certain sectors like in medicine and always more balanced, but especially in the industrial field and in the VC investment field, you mostly have either completely male teams or you have one woman. Yeah,
so still
it's still the case. Yeah, it's different again in Scandinavia, but there are not many German or Austrian VC funds. I think Speed Invest is one example, if I say Austria, but where you have several women.
Oliver Holle is not a woman, I guess. but why is that? I had a discussion with Jeevan Sana in January. She's from Playfair Capital and they asked her the same question. What's the root cause? Why do you think there are not so many women in the VC landscape? Is it because women just don't like it? Is it because there are evil men who prohibit women from entering the space? What's the root cause, in your opinion? How can we fix that?
So there are several. Yes, of course, there are many biases in the industry. I was surprised when I entered it how big they were. But there was, for only now, there was last week in Financial Times, they were quoting a scientific study where they found that male investors invested more in female founders when the female founder was good looking. Yeah. So if there are these biases towards founders, then obviously there are also biases towards investment managers whom they hire. And this is proven by science, but also anecdotally, I know so many women who start somewhere in a fund and who after 2-3 years just feel, I can't get there. I don't get the same mentoring, coaching. I don't get the same chances there. They all want to hire women. They all say it, but fundamentally then, so it doesn't work. Yeah. So it's really difficult. And I mean, I'm here to change that. And I think it can't be. Yeah. And it's also, you have since decades, you have these debates in engineering and then yes, women maybe prefer less science and math topics and have other strengths. But for an investor, especially a VC investor, this actually perfectly fits the strengths of women. Yeah. So this is a lot, early stage investing is a lot about investing in the founding team. So psychology, which is the female topic. Then yes, it is about finance, yeah, but we have in management and all, we have 50% women. And then it's about networking. This is again a woman topic per se, yeah. So and then also I have to say, I think investing is one of the most flexible job in terms of work hours, yeah. So it's actually very family friendly. I can decide when I speak to founders and I can set my schedule. Yes, I'm working a lot, but it's very rarely that I need to do the call at 6 p.m. when I maybe want to have dinner with my family. So there are no real big reasons. So I think it comes back to biases, also maybe to a bit less risk appetite at many women. Mm. Yeah, so an investment career is where the base salary is.
But doesn't make this risk aversion, doesn't it make women better investors than men?
So there are studies that, for example, female founders, they get less money, but with the money that they get, they bring the company further because they are more conservative and are worried that they will not close the next funding round if they don't realize certain things. So yes, there are certain things, but on the contrary, and you can, of course, also argue that the classical software venture capital game is all about the winner. So if you do 20 investments, you need the one or two fund returners who are really outsized things. And then you have 18 or 19 companies where it doesn't matter much if they go completely bankrupt or if they are somehow small and mediocre. So you can, of course, also argue that this is about taking high risks and having very strong conviction. But I don't think that women cannot do that. Yeah. So I mean, women are also 50% of the consumers. So I'm also convinced that there are many trends and theses that they see more obviously, yeah, and understand better. And so I think it's just a gap that we need to close. And I'm very sick of all these arguments. Oh, we don't find the women. They don't exist. So,
really? These are the arguments on the table? They don't exist? I think one of the best tech investors still is Cathie Wood. I mean, she's a little bit criticized lately because, of course, I mean, when you invest in tech, you have this bubble territory, then it falls down. But she's really doing a great job diligently researching the companies, putting all the research out on the market. I think we should have 50% women and 50% men from diverse social backgrounds, diverse ethnicities. I think there is no reason not to do that.
Yes.
Sisters.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Super. We agree. There was one story. Kevin O'Leary is an investor from the United States. He's, I think, in Shark Tank. He came a little bit under scrutiny with the FTX case in the last half year. But before that, he made a very interesting point on a podcast. He also got the question why he invests in women. And it was a traditional white male podcast, and everybody expected some dirty, politically incorrect answer. And his answer was quite short. He said, I invest in women because they are good in building companies. So his argument was that 80% of his profits he makes with his investments are from female-led companies and not from male-led companies. And he criticized the men specifically in this comment that they take too much risks. So taking risk is good, but not too much. And when you said, I mean, it's the power law, I think Sebastian Malaby described it very good in his book. This is one book I can recommend about venture capital. When you find the winner, it's good, but nobody, even statistically, picking 10 companies and expecting that one is this power law winner is a huge gamble. Still, when we talk about 10 years, there is no guarantee that one of these companies is the big winner. You can easily select 10 companies and burn all your capital within 1 year. I
think this brings us back to hardware investing. I think I'm convinced in hardware investing, it will be different. There will be more companies who grow good and quickly, and we will probably from our 20 investments have rather 3 or 4 who are very big. But then we will also have many more that are okay-ish and only few that are really a complete no-show, because there's also more substance. There are patents, there is machinery at some point in time. Also our co-investors. Yeah. So we invest, and then in the next round, there are corporate investors, there is private equity, and they have a totally different risk appetite. They ideally like no companies in their portfolio that fail. Yeah. So, so also we need to ensure already that we mitigate some of the risks. So I think this is also something that is, showing there is a trend. And maybe this is then even better to get more women into this side of investing. Yeah.
why not? There is no reason not to. At the end of the day, I think when it comes to investing, it's only the return that count. And looking at the statistics, I think they are more favorable. Unfortunately, they are more favorable for women in investing than for men in investing. My opinion. When we talk about investing, there is always this bubble territory. And I made a lot of investment mistakes in the last 20 years, always investing at the highs. When I look at the climate tech space, especially with the recent development, Brussels, European Union, pushes a lot of money into that space. Also, the Biden administration has, I think, passed a bill last year with the budget, I think, with several trillion dollars going into that space. When I look at the companies on the stock market, many of them are at the all-time highs or close. Do you see a bubble currently in the climate tech space, or is it just my media perception?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Coaching Conversation 2024. This podcast is 100% dedicated to leadership and leadership within the workplace coaching area. We work with companies throughout the world teaching leaders how to coach their employees. This podcast is dedicated to teaching specific strategies, frameworks, coaching models, and now artificial intelligence strategies to help leaders drive greater teamwork, collaboration, cooperation, greater attitudes, better motivation, coaching career development, just to name a few. I hope you'll check out our podcast.
So I wouldn't say in the climate tech space. I think there are definitely some areas. I mentioned electric vehicles, electrolyzers earlier, also food tech, some companies already have now way lower valuations. So there are certain areas, but there are also so many that are still not understood by enough investors. So like recycling cases, actually, when you look at them, they often just make total sense. Yeah, not to throw something away or burn it, but to actually reuse it. But there are not many investors who go there. And there are many places like that where it's still far away from a bubble. Yeah. And this is, I think, something for us to look at very careful and to in these different sectors to understand these different dynamics and where it is in the S-hype curve currently.
So you're really part of the ecosystem and have deep insights into the system where investors invest. I think this is a huge differentiator.
Yep.
That's good to hear. You have a lot of conviction in climate tech and believe that now is the best time to invest in that. How should I phrase that question correctly, not to insult you? Because we have all the hard topics already on the table. When I had my education in the 90s, my only expectation was to invest your money, come back and get your return, but leave the company alone and leave the executives alone. When I look now at the startup world, I very often get the question, how do investors help the company? When I also look at how investors present themselves on LinkedIn, they always present themselves with a little bit of extra and they do extra work for their startups. What's Climentum's position on in that space? How do you support your startups?
Yeah. So I think a core value add of all investors is the financing expertise and also the support in the next financing round. Yeah? And I think this is also very crucial for us. And in our ecosystem, the next round will be different than in the classical software ecosystem, as I explained before. In addition, we have one of our partners, Stefan, is a true expert in how to calculate climate. And there's a scientific methodology called life cycle assessment, LCAs. We do that in the due diligence process already and give this to the company. So they have something where they can actually have then actually with scientific methodologies calculated what the potential of their technology is. This is something that they can use for customers, for grants, for the next financing round and so on. And we also help them to navigate in this how to get actually more grants and how to access carbon markets, voluntary carbon markets, and so on. Yeah. So this climate impact angle is the second strong thing. And we are in SFDR Article 9 fund. So this is from the European Commission, the classifications of funds. Article 8 is also a bit green, but a normal fund can relatively easily become Article 8. Article 9 is way harder. And we already have cases where the founder said, the round is actually full, but we want you in the round because we want this Article 9 stamp and we want to use that. And this means something to us. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's good to hear. There are other topics that startups often bring to the table. So financing is clear that you help the companies. Then you bring a lot of expertise on the table and also your business network. But sometimes I hear also that startups expect from VCs to help them with the hiring, to find the right people for leadership positions. What's your take on that additional demands from startups? Are you as Climentum set up to be something like the extended workbench of startups, or do you make a clear cut and say, look, I mean, we give you the money. We, of course, help you with one or the other introduction. But at the end of the day, it's you who needs to execute. Where do you position Climentum in that game?
It's definitely the second. So the founders need to manage the company. And obviously, there are topics across different companies where we see similar questions and where we can help with connections between founders or to a hiring agency or a sales agency or whatever is the topic. But hiring recruiters or marketing people or whatever for our portfolio company is definitely not the best use of our LP's money. So at the end, this needs to be paid, and this either needs to be paid by the portfolio companies or by our LPs, and we're not doing that.
What in your collaboration with a startup company, do you take up board seats?
Yes, yeah. So we are very collaborative with other VC funds or also other types of investors. So we don't always need to lead. We also don't need always 10% or whatever threshold. So we're also willing to co-lead or to follow a strong investor. But especially if we lead, we take a board seat and we take this serious and work with the company throughout the years. Yeah.
And how often do you do your board meetings in the year?
So this is also different by country. So in many countries, the board meetings are very formal, and you have actually a agenda of formal items that you need to get through. And then the more important stuff is the advisory. And this is day to day. So I'm on WhatsApp with all of them very regularly, sometimes every day. Sometimes it's we don't talk about anything for 2 weeks because it's just clear what they need to focus on and then what I focus on. But this is what startups need. Yeah, it doesn't help to have once a month, once a quarter, once a year, something fixed in the calendar. You need ad hoc advice. They need to decide quickly. And then and this is way more important. Yeah.
So your startups can reach out to you anytime when they have a question.
Yes, yes.
That's good. That's great. That's great. That's also a strong USP.
Absolutely. And also we are relatively many partners, which also means that every founder has a partner as a counterpart. Yeah.
How many startups do you manage in your as a person?
I mean, we are a new fund. We had our first closing last summer, so we are operational for a year now, and we have now done 8 investments, and 4 of them I'm currently managing. Mm-hmm. But obviously this will grow. Yeah. So with this first fund, we'll do around 20 investments, and then we'll have a second and third fund. And then, but on the other hand, it's also typically the involvement is the highest between the first funding round and the next one, because then typically other investors come in who also take part of the advisory and coaching. But so I would assume in a steady state, I will always have something below 10, so maybe around 8-ish or so companies that I really take care of. Yeah.
You mentioned an interesting part for me. So Climentum is not a one-trick pony to say we do one fund. We hope that we find before 20 investments the one power law winner. take the money and leave. You said you also have plans already for your second, third, fourth, fifth fund. So Climentum is set up to play an important role for decades in the entire ecosystem.
Yes, that's the aspiration. Because unfortunately, the problem will also not be solved with this one fund. More to do.
20 companies that we are done with.
The climate. This would climate be change actually. Solved.
Yeah. I fear no. That's true. How do you see fundraising with your fund? I mean, Brussels is doing a lot of regulatory work, pushes money into the system. Biden administration pushes money into the system. It looks to me like also the Saudi Arabian oil companies start investing in that space. How do you see the availability of capital, private capital, not public funds, private capital on the market for startups?
So there's definitely more capital coming in, but there are also several things that don't work so well. So for example, most of the climate tech funds are first-time funds like us, and especially big private investors just don't do that. Yeah, mm-hmm. They have some rules, only second or even third funds and stuff like that. So it's so in 2020, 2021, it was easier to raise money, and now that all the market is going down, it's also harder for all of us. We're fortunately far enough with our fundraising that we don't need to worry. Yeah, we are actually still fundraising until September, and we are also open for additional tickets. But we're fortunate enough that we could convince strong investors. So we have the Danish Growth Fund, which is a government fund. We have a bank from Denmark. We have BASF, but also many family offices and so on. That are currently invested in the fund. Yeah, but it's definitely not easier. But on the other hand, I'm very happy. Yeah. So our fund might be a few million smaller than it would have been if we would have raised in 2020, but we could start investing at a very good time. Yeah. So in our segment, the valuations have not crashed down, but at least they are more moderate. Yeah. So in our portfolio, we have no companies where we would now say, oh, this was actually a high valuation. And when we think about the next round, how can we even get there?
Justify that.
Yeah. So we actually have a good chance to build up a super healthy portfolio and also show nice traction. And this will also, of course, also be important when raising the next fund and ultimately returning the fund. Yeah.
Is there still some room in your industry for valuation reset southwards?
Yeah, absolutely. So this, I would say the early stage was never that affected. It didn't go so super crazy. And now it also got down a bit, but not super much. But in the later stage, it was very drastic. And we also have, I mean, there are some examples. Infarm was now a lot in the press. Yeah, that was very overhyped and got down massively. But it's again, segment by segment, we see others like NPAL who are still growing the valuations. So, yeah. I think fundamentally the climate tech segment is stronger than others. Mm. And, but we also cannot ignore the current market.
2022, I mean, I love tech investments on the public market, and 2022 was not fun. So it's everything, I think, went southwards by at least 50%.
Yeah, it's very difficult. And I mean, I speak to so many founders who are really struggling. And I mean, that's really tough. Yeah, if you have a good company, great employees, a good technology, and the market is so much against you. Yeah.
You mentioned Speed Invest before, and they did a study where they asked European investors what the flaws of the European ecosystems are. And my point when I look at our ecosystem in the European Union is always that for startups with a pharma background, there is not enough capital, private capital on the market. So that's the reason why I asked you this question. How do you see the availability of private capital for startups or scale-up companies? And the usual advice I give to companies who want to start here in Europe is, principle, raise your seed round, get public funds, but be aware of the situation that after the Series A, it's highly unlikely to close a Series B, Series C, Series D, or with European investors only, or do an IPO in Europe with European investors only. So the way forward is to sell your company to the industry, or you relocate to the United States, because there is much more capital available and there are much more investors who want to invest in later stage companies and also support IPO aspirations. How is the availability of private capital in your area? Do you see the possibility or the potential in climate tech companies to find also follow-on investors solely in Europe and do an IPO in Europe? Or do you also have a similar perception that you say, okay, I mean, at the end of the day, if you can't sell your company here in Europe, you need to go to the United States?
I mean, we will see that over the next decade. I think it should be possible, because a lot of the climate tech is much more to the industrial core of Europe, and a lot of the private money will come from corporates or from families who have made their money in industrial stuff. And it's probably an easier thing from a successful machinery company where you made your money to invest in, I don't know, recycling or new packaging technologies than to do software. Yeah. That's one thing. The other is that US investors are also actively looking at Europe, and I expect them to do that even more, because they see that Europe is very far in many technologies and has a lot to offer. And they also see that climate tech is very political in the US. And yes, there is this big package and all. But it's also, if the next government comes and it's the Republicans, it can also be shredded. And so it's way more certain that Europe will stay for the next 20 years on this green train than the US. So I'll also expect more US investors to continue investing in the European ecosystem.
When I was in my 20s, it was the 90s, and Europe was leading in many industries back then, European companies. Then came the new millennium, and I think with the dot-com bubble burst in 2000, it was a wipeout of European digital companies. So when I look now on the landscape, we have Alphabet, we have Apple, we have Microsoft, no European leading company in these markets. I think the Nokias and the Siemens of the days back then, or StudiVZ, I think it was similar to Facebook 20 years ago, they all went extinct. There were no investment capital, was no investment capital. And you mentioned that in climate tech, Europe, in your opinion, has a leading role. So we have more companies, we have better technology. Is this the right perception? Are we really in the lead in these areas?
I wouldn't say in the lead, but I would say we still have the chance to stay meaningful there. But it's not defined. Yeah, it's also in China, a lot is happening. And this whole China-US rivalry is definitely a high risk for us. We have now higher pressure to act because of the Russia-Ukraine war and the energy price implications that we have here. So this is also, of course, revealing some more energy and some more urgency, but also creating problems. Yeah, high energy prices also for the industry bad. So it's not yet decided, but I think we have a chance to have a certain share, and I'm working that we'll take this chance and do something out of it. Yeah.
What, in your opinion, what needs Europe to take the lead, to take the lead in green technology, climate tech?
I think, again, there's not one answer, but definitely regulations and security on certain regulations is definitely important. Also the carbon markets to maybe go some steps further there. Yes, it is also about money and deploying money also in an accessible way, because especially what the financing institutes of the European Union do, this is, especially for startups early stage, this is so crazy. I mean, there are, if you are a startup and you want to get 2-3 million EU funding, the first thing you should do is hire a consultant who helps you with the application forms. Yeah, this cannot be. This is so crazy. Yeah. So get a bit more pragmatic in this way. Absolutely. I know it's not easy. It's still government money from taxpayers that we need to spend wisely and not, and all that. But yeah, there are several of these things here to unleash the potential that is definitely there.
Yeah, it would be good to have private additional private money. I mean, at the end of the day, when it wants to raise public money, always need private money. Public money is available, but private capital, especially from entrepreneurs.
Yeah, but also from the whole pension system. I mean, this is such a big difference that the US pension money is in large shares also in private equity venture. And this is way, way, way less in Europe. And this is also something that we need to, that needs to change. Yeah.
Open doors here. As I say the same since I think 2013, 14, that a lot of fund, especially here in Austria, we have a lot of foundations. Also insurance companies, and they could do much more without investing in risky assets. I mean, when they invest in venture funds, for example, like in your fund, and you can diversify your portfolio. So you don't buy only one company, you invest in 20 companies. When you look at the statistics, it's next to impossible that the fund is a complete loss. So it's 100% lost.
I have to say, if you look in the data, it's not so easy to return a VC fund. And there's quite a big share of funds that stay below the 1x, or at least below a really attractive IRR. So it's not so easy. I understand why it is a high risk asset class, but that does just mean that you need to balance your portfolio. Yeah, that does not mean you shouldn't touch it.
I think big corporations can put, I think, for example, 1% in VC funds without risking their existence, which helps drive the ecosystem forward on one hand, but also opens the door to, I would say, the possibility to create returns, even if there is a risk. But what options do they have? On the other hand, I mean, they can invest in Berkshire, then they also risk everything, because who knows what happens with Berkshire when Warren Buffett is not there. They can invest in interest-bearing whatever they find on the market, but also this can change very quickly, as we saw in the last 10 years, up and down.
Yeah. Yeah, but at least at the moment, debt financing and all this is pretty attractive. Yeah, and if you get double-digit interest rates on debt, we as VC and private equity industry need to have good arguments and good returns to actually
The biggest learning I made on public markets is you need to buy the assets when nobody wants them. So when they are looking for other alternatives, because then you can buy low. When now nobody wants to invest in venture funds, I think it's the best time to invest in venture funds.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. I indeed agree. I think now is a good time to invest, because the portfolio that you can build up in 22, 23 will be very healthy. And towards the end of the decade, we will have a very good exit momentum, because many corporates have targets, climate targets for 2030, 2035. So the acquisition appetite will be way higher. This is definitely true.
I couldn't agree more. You mentioned 2030, 2035, and further along. Let's look into your crystal ball.
Yeah.
And it's just guesswork. When we look into the future, and let's say 20 years, and you achieved your biggest dreams, how does the world look like then?
So I would hope that we have made a transition towards a more sustainable industry and society without losing too many people, both here in Central Europe, yeah, I mean, but also on the southern side of the planet, yeah. And that we can stay, 7 billion people, hopefully continue to decrease the share of the super poor, and somehow manage to keep this earth a place where you can live and where so many people can live. Yeah. I think, and I just hope that this does, that we can do that without any big tragedies. I mean, what we see in Ukraine currently, that a complete country is destroyed, this is already so massive. And there are so many other wars that we don't talk that much about. But there is a severe risk that also all this, the stuff that that are triggered more by climate change can lead to more and more catastrophes. And I just hope that we have as few as possible of these.
Yeah, totally agree. No wars, please. This would be devastating for Europe. I hope we continue what we started in 1945. And also with the European Union, that we keep Europe safe and without wars. At least when this in the Ukraine should stop, hopefully also pretty soon. Let's talk about investments.
Yeah.
And what was your favorite investment that you did?
No, I don't have a favorite one. I like all of them for different reasons.
Due to time constraints, I mean, we could also sit here until 3 p.m. So I have the next meeting at 3 p.m. But due to the time constraints, maybe you can pick one to demonstrate, to help people understand when they should approach you. So to describe with one of your portfolio investments, why you decided to invest in that, why you like the company, what's the strength of the company, and what's it that you're looking for in companies?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can select Fermify, which is a Vienna-based biotech company that produces in a fermentation process casein, which is the base for vegan cheese. So the whole protein market is one that where we believe we need to feed 7 billion people, and we need to do that with less land, because we need more land for trees. And with less animals, this goes more to plant based and to fermentation processes and stuff like that. So we have studied this fundamentally. We also defined some areas where we think we as a fund are strong. So, for example, we would in the food space, we would not invest in B2C brands because we don't have this consumer branding expertise. Mm-hmm. So we prefer B2B models. And we also fundamentally believe that the food giants will win. Yeah. So as you see it with alternative meat, so plant-based meat, now all the Nestle's and all have the large products in the supermarkets at competitive cost. And this is what wins. So, and then we got introduced to Fermify by a fund from Switzerland called Übermorgen. And what I liked immediately was their B2B model. So they work with cheese companies who currently produce cheese and who know everything about milk and the cheese making process, but who are no biotechnicians at all. And they don't have any fermenters there. And Fermify enables these companies to set up a vegan cheese line, and to produce cheese that really tastes like cheese and has the meltability and all the stuff that we like about cheese, because plant-based cheese does currently not work. So we only have 2% of the cheese market is vegan, while, for example, 20% of the European milk market is vegan, plant-based, because the milk alternative is there, it's tasty now, and several people have switched. And for cheese, it's just not good enough. And so then we started the due diligence, we talked to customers, we went into the technology. So we have some biotech expertise in our fund. So we looked very deep in what Eva and Christoph, the two founders, can, and found that very convincing. And then we ultimately decided to invest. Yeah. So we look for companies that are at the stage where they have the first revenues or will have them soon, where we see a reason why this can grow very quickly. In this case, we see that because they have so good connections to these cheese companies, and there are several that they could sign quickly. And then these cheese companies actually have easier access to CapEx than a small startup has. And we look for distinctive technologies. And Fermify is actually one of the first ones who can actually make cheese with casein that tastes like something that you would also call cheese. Yeah, so...
Is it really tasting like cheese?
Yes.
You tried it?
Yes, I tried it.
Yeah.
Yes.
So really like real cheese, and they can model, they can basically mimic every sort, every kind of cheese that's on the market.
In theory, they can. I tried mozzarella and feta. Yeah, so these are the two that I tried.
Cool. There's no difference.
I mean, it has no milk in it, so there's a big difference, but the taste...
Taste-wise, I'm saying.
The taste, I'm pretty sure that in a blind tasting, you and me would not taste so different. Yeah.
That's impressive. That's impressive. And it also explains what you're looking for, I think, very well. You're looking for B2B models. So it's not your plan to scale the next Tesla, for example, to find this one Elon Musk who then builds everything himself and you need trillions or billions flowing in. You're more looking for these specialist companies, if I understood it right, who do one thing very well and are aware that larger corporations, it's in principle the pharma model. So larger corporations already have a sound customer base, can invest a lot and are looking more for licensing deals, for example. It's also your preferred model.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you want to have, on one hand, a clear definition how the company reduces CO2, which I think in terms of milk is quite simple. More vegan cheese alternatives on the market, less milk consumption, less cattle, less CO2. Mm-hmm. The second part that's very important. You need proficiency on the team. As far as I remember, Fermify, they have strong ties to the Technical University of Vienna, so they have a sound science base. And they also have people on their team who, what you mentioned, understand how to negotiate licensing deals with their respective industries. It's also an important part.
Exactly. And Eva is a serial entrepreneur, so she has already built a food tech company and exited it. Yeah.
The ecosystem, I think, in Austria will love you for the investment here in Austria. One question, I mean, with Fermify, you have an Austrian company in your portfolio. How do you see the Austrian ecosystem from the Berlin perspective?
I'm not an expert on that. I couldn't judge. I think it's definitely evolving. It has way more potential. It can grow bigger, but I really can't judge. I couldn't tell you the 10 most promising Austrian startups.
Okay. Then let's look at your stay with your space. I mean, this is probably an important question for LPs. Investing is not very difficult. I mean, you can throw your money on the stock market and burn it very easily. So this is especially in these days. The interesting thing is always how do funds make a difference? What do they do to find better opportunities on the market? And I think this is the secret. It's also not easy to make money on the public market. I think 95% of people who try to get rich on the stock market lose money, don't make money on the stock market. I think it's only 5% when you look at the statistics who really produce returns. And it's a very small percentage when you look at these outstanding returns of above 10 to 20%. Warren Buffett, the best investor, makes, I think, a little bit below 20% in the last 60 years. But the majority of his returns were back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s of the last century. What's your secret sauce in finding companies? How do you find your deal flow where you are convinced that in this deal flow are the winners of tomorrow?
So it's a smart combination of smart people who have networks, who have knowledge and hypotheses on thesis and what will happen. And then it's combining that with data. Yeah, unfortunately, there are many data sources out there that you can look at and aggregate, which makes it also easier for smaller funds to just do that. And it's always this combination. Yeah.
Super. Let me ask you a personal question that I find very interesting with people who have big aspirations to change the world. I mean, it's basically what you take up is a contrarian position. So you're looking on one hand, I mean, you're looking in a philanthropic area, climate tech. You also want to make profits for your LPs. And you look in small areas that that are not existing currently in the public eye. So it's not like managing a football team who's in the Champions League and all over the media. And I can imagine that, I mean, I'm in pharma and very often I get pushbacks because except during the pandemic, nobody likes the pharma industry. What I'm curious about to learn from you is what keeps you going? I mean, you must also have, in my opinion, probably some pushbacks. Nobody's interested in the areas. Then you have to find companies that nobody wants to invest in, have to convince LPs to invest in these companies. What gets you up in the morning?
So I think, to be honest, this is a bit big privilege that I have. Yeah, to have a job where I can talk with great founders on exciting technologies, and I still feel that this is really an absolute dream job. I also think we are still in the honeymoon phase of our fund. We did our first investments. All these companies still have money. We don't yet have any that is struggling, and we have to make potentially tough decisions also not to give money to some anymore. So I know that also these times will come. But it's, for me, it's also, I'm a person, I had my own software company. And what I realized then was I'm not good in optimizing every day the same thing. Yeah. So the sales of a software make the pitch 2% better. I'm someone who's good at managing many different topics and jumping from one to the other. And I think this is also my trick when I'm, when I don't feel like, So I can just prioritize my time and do different things and look at different companies. And there are weeks where I focus a lot on fundraising. There are other weeks where big conferences are and it's a lot about networking. And then there are weeks when I go down, look into companies, do due diligence, look at data. And this is something that gives me a lot of energy, yeah, that I can also have. And I have a lot of degrees of freedom to decide when exactly I do what.
Yeah, it's always the question about fire culture in my community and I think also in other ecosystems. You said your fund is still in the honeymoon phase and someday the honeymoon phase will be over, and you also had the career before Climentum. What I'm curious to learn is how do you handle these times when there is no honeymoon, when the going gets tough? How do you manage failures? What's your trick?
So I think I have a lot of small sources of energy that I can pull. Yeah, typically I need to digest by talking to people I trust. I'm not good in solving something on my own. So I could never do a single GP fund. I need people around me. And then I think I'm relatively good in putting something aside and looking at it half a day or a week later, and getting a fresh perspective and a fresh appetite to improve that and make that better. So I never really stop working. I'm always on, but I can also relatively easy switch off from the topics that I'm currently annoyed on. And then what very often happens that actually after some time where I looked at something else, and this can be my kids, that can be another company that's currently easier, then I have a fresh idea and also the power and energy to go back to this. Yeah.
How about your kids? How do you manage family and business life?
So as mentioned before, I think investors have the great benefits of flexibility. So compared to founding a company or being a McKinsey partner or many other career options, I have tons of flexibility. Nevertheless, I have a lot to do. So this means I'll prioritize whatever is more urgent. I also work with a Scandinavian team in Scandinavia. This whole work-life balance topic is very different. For example, when we did our launch event in Copenhagen, I said, okay, let's start at 6 p.m. My colleagues were like, what? No, we start at 3. At 6, most people will go because they have dinner with their family at home. Yeah, so there, it's much more around lunches and you do the networking in the core working hours, and having an evening event is a rare exception, which is here in our community. It's almost expected that very regularly you network for dinners and all that stuff. Yeah. So these are things that I do, but I limit them to a certain degree. Also travel. Yeah. I focus on Europe. I wouldn't want to invest in a fund that invests a lot in the US or stuff like that. Yeah. So the stuff that I know that are difficult for my family, I'll limit, and I have selected a setup that allows that. Mm-hmm. And then I'm very efficient. Yeah. I'm very good. If I know I have 45 minutes and then I'll pick up my kids, then I get a lot done in 45 minutes.
That's true. I think, what's the name of this law? I forgot it, but it goes like, a task takes the time you dedicate to the task. If it's 4 hours, it's 4 hours. If it's 30 minutes, it's 30 minutes and the task is done. So do you agree to this statement from your personal life, basically?
For many things I do. What is also true that I, as a working mom, what I sometimes miss is this open-end working on something which is more complex, yeah, something that just requires iterations and thinking. And that is very hard for me. For example, I hate writing white papers. But I've now actually decided to really not do it much anymore. And some other people need to do it. And this is something that that does not fit well in this. I give it X hours. And I'm just, this is drowning me then, because then I say, okay, today afternoon, I have 3 hours for it. And then I'm still not done. And then this is something that I don't like so much. But I think this is also, I mean, when you're getting older, you know what you're good at and what you're not good at. And it's always better to focus on your strengths than to work on your development needs. Yeah. Rather find the right team to take over the stuff that you're not that good in.
I agree, it's a contrarian approach to the school system.
Yes.
You mentioned white paper. I heard this term very often with the blockchain space. What's the important role, in your opinion, of white papers these days? Do we need them, or can we forget about it?
So, I mean, I think the core of a fund is to do great investments. That's what we should focus on. And I'm not a big fan of hiring a big team of communication guys who just, also in the social media world, who just generate buzz and stuff to just have clicks and likes and whatever. Mm. But nevertheless, when you think about a segment and a problem, we sometimes have something to say, and we learn so much that it just makes sense to summarize it. And when you summarize it and publish it, you also get more impact on input on that. So, for example, I decided to write an article about the problems of financing first of a kind manufacturing plants, because this is something that I spent so much time on, and I learned a lot, but I still have open questions. So I decided to write down my state and what I learned and what I still not know. And this was very helpful. Yeah. So many people responded to it and checked in, and I got additional contacts to potential investors who are interested in these type of things. So then it helps. But you shouldn't say, oh, we as a fund, we have the target every month, we need to publish the next white paper. So now it's on you. You have to do it. Yeah. So that doesn't make sense.
No, to the degree, writing helps to sort thoughts. It's a very important task. I like writing a lot. I'm almost through with my questions. Let me ask you one question. Did I miss anything in our conversation? Is there any topic that you would like to talk about and I didn't tackle so far?
No, I think we covered a broad range. Yeah.
So when someone is listening right now who wants to either join your ecosystem as a startup or as an LP, and want to reach out to you, how should they do it?
Yeah. So for companies, so we like companies that are in late seed or series A, so that ideally already have revenues or will have them soon, and that have a really big climate impact. B2B, this is what we like. Please apply on our website. You can also email me, but it's just, it's just way more efficient, because then we give it directly to the one who takes care and we have all the information that we need. So please fill in the form in the website, and we will definitely look at it. For people who are interested to invest in our fund, this is possible for large investors, but also for people who only have 100 or 200,000 euros. So this is in our setup also possible. You can write to hello@climentum.com. Very simple, hello. and we will reach that. And of course, also feel free to reach out to me personally, LinkedIn. Yeah, I'm aware. Also for co-investors who would like to invest with us, industry experts on certain sectors, always interested to be in contact.
Super. Then I will put your contact data in the description of the podcast episode whenever I post something and make a little bit of buzz on the internet. I will put your LinkedIn profile in the description so people can actively reach out to you on LinkedIn, and you read your messages, I guess, then.
I do, LinkedIn. Yes.
So it's a very active profile and you use it for communication.
Yes.
That brings us to the end of our insightful conversation with Dörte Hirschberg. We dove deep into the world of climate tech investing, explored the balance of family and career, and discussed the future of our planet. If you found value in this episode, please take a moment to like, share, and comment. Your interaction not only helps us to reach more people, but also enables us to continue bringing in more speakers and creating more content like this. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on our latest episodes. Thank you for joining me on this journey. Until next time, keep learning and keep growing.